Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week, we'll tell you why so many Israelis are protesting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. We'll tell you what those in favor of BDS don't want people to know. And we have a heartwarming story with the owner of the New England Patriots, not one of my personal favorite teams, how he, Robert Kraft, is trying to fight anti-Semitism. That and so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
Maureen Jaffe.
And Laureen, you obviously are into the holidays probably more than anybody I know. And this will be airing on the radio station on Arab Passover. But on the podcast, we'll be right in the throes of Passover.
That's right. So, Asmei Pesach, everybody. This is very exciting. So, obviously, I've been busy packing up my normal kitchen, unpacking our Pesach kitchen, chopping, slicing, dicing, getting things ready, getting everything washed. It's a lot of work, but we're really excited. You know,
we changed dishes at our house when I was growing up. We had to go down, my brother and I would go down to the basement and bring up the Passover dishes, take down the the chametz dishes. And every year. And I also remember, you'll like this, Laureen, my dad took me to an opening day at Wrigley Field, which was right in the middle of Passover. And I was hungry. I was a kid. I was young. And all he would let me eat was peanuts, which he thought were kosher for Passover. Whether they were or not, I don't know. But I remember that it seared into my brain. I wanted a hot dog. And he goes, nah, you can't have one.
You can't have the bun. That's right. No hot dog. So that's so cute. But I'm excited. And we got, you know, lots of little ones with us this year. So we got some new Haggadahs for the little ones, PJ Library, which is a great program that provides, you know, will ship Jewish books to young families for their children. They, you know, I think it's like a club membership, and they do it, I think, at like low to no cost for Jewish families. But they put out a Haggadah that you can use for a Seder for children. So we've got, you know, our PJ Library Haggadahs, and, you know, and we're going to watch Prince of Egypt before the Seder begins. So earlier in the day, we'll watch Prince of Egypt, which was like a 1998 DreamWorks film, which is a great.
Yeah, you were telling me about that the other day. I've never heard of it, nor have I ever seen it.
It's such a great, I love it. I think it's like the best Exodus movie there is. Like, you know, even as good as Charlton Heston, except for it's in cartoon form, it's by DreamWorks. I mean, they've got great music. The story is phenomenal. I mean, I think, you know, especially if you've got kids, this is a great way to sort of relay, this is why we're doing what we're doing tonight.
and that's wonderful. But there is a lot of news going on. And I know you and I really disagree on that. But Netanyahu and Israel, I think that the judicial reforms, which are now on hold, are really hurting Israel. I think they're dividing Israel. I think they're hurting Israel in the United States. I think it's just crazy.
You know, I've got very strong opinions on this. And
gee, that's a surprise. You having strong opinions?
Yes. Involved, how it's being funded. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, when you're looking at polling different things, you know, I've read articles and pieces that like up to two-thirds of the Israeli populace actually supports reforms and bringing reforms to the system. And so, you know, it's just sort of who's behind the funding. And I know you and I had this whole debate over Movement for Quality Government, but they are receiving, like, they are the name and face behind, you know, the movement. So when you think about who's actually...
Well, but that's true. But the money that the State Department gave to that organization was to try to foster a two-state solution. And they deny that any of the, obviously they oppose, it's an NGO, a non-governmental organization. They definitely opposed Netanyahu and did everything they could to defeat them. But they said they didn't commingle those funds, and that the money that they received from the State Department, and the Trump administration gave money from the State Department as well, that it is not to defeat Netanyahu and not to cause protests there.
Okay, so they
said they don't commingle the funds. They did get the money. There's no question about it. But well, that's for a two-state solution, which I'm all in favor of.
So they put up a Chinese wall in their bank account and said, this money is for X, but all our other money is for Y, which is, first of all, to file a petition the first day that Benjamin Netanyahu was elected to challenge whether or not he could be prime minister, or to file petitions with the Supreme Court to challenge his ministers, or it's our face that's buying, that's literally leasing all the buses and purchasing all the billboards and all the ads and all the signs and pretty much driving all
they are anti-Netanyahu. I will not dispute that, but can't you believe that the State Department was trying to foster a two-state solution?
You know why? Because this organization also has a post-Zionist curricula that they teach within Israeli schools, which in essence tells Jewish students that religion and the Jewish experience is irrelevant. And I think it's so much more than that. And I think we need to be, you know, questioning that. And it's not even like, hey, we only gave you a nominal amount of money. It's more about, here's money coming from the U.S. State Department to this organization that's doing these specific things to subvert, you know, a prime minister and an Israeli government. I think that's what really shades this. I think that's what the question is. And which, by the way, under the Obama administration, the State Department gave like an obscene amount of money, like $350,000 to another organization, One Voice in Israel, that was out there actively at that time trying to subvert
Benjamin. And again, One Voice says the funds were not commingled. The funds were to foster a two-state solution. They admit that they tried everything they could to defeat Netanyahu. But they
$350,000. Nobody's auditing them to see where the money went. But the point is that it was the U.S. State Department.
They also gave money to the Palestinians, too, to try to bring everybody together to do that. It wasn't just Israel. It was to the Palestinians as well. They're trying to bring together a two-state solution.
I'm so not buying that. Then why was everybody against Trump's plan, which, by the way, was the best plan for a two-state solution that's ever been proposed with literally financing and from all the Arab states? And like $50 billion to the Palestinian Authority and infrastructure and everything else. And everybody like screamed bloody murder and they're against it. So, you know, and that was probably the closest we've been in decades to a two-state solution. But I think the problem is that it has the appearance of impropriety because you have the U.S. State Department's name. You know,
so I will agree with you. It might have the appearance of impropriety. I'll agree. But I still think that for the most part, and you think that there are people in the State Department that are anti-Israel, and there probably are because there are everywhere. But you think that there is ulterior motives. It doesn't necessarily look great, but I think that they were trying to foster the two-state solution, which is the only thing that in my mind brings peace to Israel. And let me also say, there are people in Israel, as you well know, protesting about all sorts of things involving Netanyahu. And of course, it's this judicial reform that he wants to do to take power away from the Supreme Court. I think it's tearing up Israel.
I mean, look, Mike, it might be. But again, the polling has said that there's up to 2/3 of Israel that actually supports reforms. So, you know, if that's the case, and then that's the will of the people. And I think we need to be mindful of that. And again, I'm still very circumspect of these protesters and of organizations that are feeling them, because there are Israel has plenty of enemies that would love to subvert her, that would love to cause chaos, that you know, look, she's got all these existential threats from Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, you know, Islamic Palestinian Jihad, you know, the Lion's Den. She's got, you know, Syria. She's got Russia. She's got all these enemies on all her borders that, you know, would love to, not to mention like BDS and everything else. But I look at that and I say, this is a problem. Like we need to make sure that we're not sort of falling into a trap of the enemy who's trying to cause chaos.
Well, but Lorene, there are secular Jews who are extremely concerned about the right wing that Netanyahu has aligned himself with in order to form a government. And they are wanting so many right wing things, and they don't want the Supreme Court to be able to rule against them. And I also think it's a ploy by Netanyahu to try to be avoiding conviction in the charges that were brought against him. Well, now, you think it's no big deal. I think it's major.
I totally don't think Netanyahu is focused on that. I mean, these were indictments that were like so absurd from like 2019. The trial started in 2021, literally April 2021, 2 years ago. And that, I mean, they've gotten literally nowhere. They've gotten nothing. I mean,
well, yeah, but Lorene, you know, you're an attorney. Justice moves slowly. They have not dropped the charges. They are still going forward. And this bill would change everything. And would protect Netanyahu. It seems so self-serving.
They say it only moves that slowly when you got nothing. They started their investigation in 2016. They brought the indictment in 2019. They started a trial 2 years ago. They literally have gotten nowhere. The judge pretty much kicked them out and said, you've got 350 errors. You got to fix all this crap. You know, you got all these issues.
They have not kicked it out of court. It's still there. And there are a portion of Israelis, a huge portion. And listen, okay, I'm older than you are. I remember the Vietnam War protest when it was just a handful of people, and it grew and it grew and it grew, and it took over the nation. That was my generation. These people are protesting now. They're concerned about the religious right just ramrodding things through. I think the secular and the religious folks are going to have a big problem in Israel. But there's a Wall Street Journal report about why people are protesting. Let's take a listen to that.
From blocking highways to forming human chains and dressing up as characters from Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, for 3 months, up to 500,000 Israelis have taken to the streets across the country to protest a judicial overhaul planned by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government. The growing revolt piled pressure on Netanyahu to suspend the overhaul until Parliament reconvenes at the end of April.
כשיש אפשרות למנוע מלחמת אחים בהידברות, אני כראש ממשלה לוקח פסק זמן להידברות.
Here's what's happening in Israel, the stakes behind Netanyahu's judicial overhaul, and where things could be headed next. There are many layers to it, but there are three things you need to understand. First is changing the committee that appoints judges. This overhaul will give the ruling coalition a majority on that committee, and that will allow them to place like-minded judges on the bench. The second pillar of the judicial overhaul is to limit the jurisdiction of the court. That means what cases will the court be able to hear? And the third thing, and perhaps the most controversial bit, is what's called the override clause. That will allow a simple majority of parliament, meaning 61 of 120 lawmakers, to override decisions of the Supreme Court. Netanyahu and his coalition partners say this judicial overhaul is necessary in order to balance out the court. They say that the court is dominated by liberals and that it's way too activist. The court itself needs a check on its power because it is essentially blocking the will of the people. For people who oppose the overhaul, they believe it will undermine the Supreme Court completely.
We came here to protest against the degradation of the Israeli democracy. We see a process where the rights of the people will be over time consumed by this theocratic government.
These protests have really exposed long-held divisions in Israeli society between its secular side and its religious, more conservative side. One of the major problems of this overhaul for the protesters is that it's being advanced by Prime Minister Netanyahu himself. Netanyahu has long been a defender of the court, and they ask themselves, why is Netanyahu suddenly supporting this massive judicial overhaul? And for them, the answer is clear. is because Benjamin Netanyahu is on trial for corruption. And if this overhaul passes, they believe he will use it in order to get out of his own legal problems. Netanyahu denies this, but the protesters at this point simply do not believe him. After Netanyahu has paused legislation, it will be very, very difficult for the opposition and ruling coalition to find an agreement on this issue because they are so far apart as it stands. Perhaps the opposition and the coalition will find a compromise, but if they don't, we can expect this conflict to come back and to come back strong.
I will admit, Laureen, it's not an easy issue. Like the name of our show, Two Jews, Three Opinions, not everybody agrees. It looks like Netanyahu's going to go back after Passover and try to pass this. I'd certainly like to see some kind of compromise.
Well, we'll see. I mean, look, the news as of, you know, tonight was that he was suspending the reform for now. You know, and Herzog is, you know, calling the parties to the table after Pesach to sit down and negotiate. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Again,
let me ask you this. And I don't know the answer, and you are much more aware of what goes on in Israeli politics. Have you ever seen an issue divide Israel as much?
I don't know. It's hard to say divide Israel as much because, again, when you look at the polling, it's not really that divided. But what we do see are violent protesters and who are being bused to protest, and those or groups that are busing them are being funded. So I think this is a well-funded movement. I think that's the difference. I think
well-funded by whom?
We don't know because the organization that has their name on the forefront, which is the organization that got $38,000 from the State Department, is receiving a lot of money from donors that we don't know.
But the Trump administration gave that organization the same amount of money.
It's not the money. It's not the amount of money. It's the fact that right now their name is on the forefront of everything trying to subvert Netanyahu's government. And more importantly, they're getting private donations and we don't know what that is because they don't have to.
I understand, but wait. You cannot call out the Biden administration for giving them funds when the Trump administration did the same thing.
But the difference, Mike, is they weren't engaged in active conduct to subvert the government at the time. There wasn't Netanyahu
back at that time trying to change the laws about the Supreme Court. It's not fair to say that it's bad when the Biden administration does it, but it's okay when the Trump administration does it.
There would have been no reason for Trump to even look at the State Department, his Mike Pompeo, as if he was going to look at it, to look at like some little entity getting $38,000 at the time. But when the movement for quality government, because they weren't doing anything at the time, but right now they are doing everything to subvert Netanyahu's government. They filed two petitions with the Supreme Court to remove him from office. I mean, they challenge everything. And it's their name, their face, that is, it's their buses, it's their billboards, it's their signs, everything. And we don't know who their private donors are because they don't have to disclose that. We only know about the State Department because that had to be disclosed. But
that's just not a fair argument, Laureen.
They weren't doing this under Trump. If you're not doing this, you have no reason to question it. Nobody knew what they were doing. Are you kidding me? I assure you, if they were doing this under his administration, Mike Pompeo would have shut that down in a heartbeat.
But you don't know. And we don't know. All we know is they both gave $38,000. And if you think $38,000 is going to foster the amount of protests that have gone in Israel,
that's
bupkis. $38,000. You know, it's not chump change, but that's bupkis when you're talking about
this all night. Of course not. Look, I said it's not the amount, it's the issue. It's the fact that their name now, that this organization's name is the face of the protest. They're the ones that are busing everybody. Like their money's coming from somewhere and we don't know because they're private donors. And that's what I've been saying all along. I'm very concerned because we don't know who's actually funding this movement. We don't. And we need to be very concerned about that. I really feel like that. Israel's got enough enemies.
Say there are American Jews that are funding that movement. A lot of American Jews that are interested in Israel are concerned about the proposals to reform the judiciary. Can not American groups? And I don't know. Yeah, it's a foreign election. I don't know. quite candidly, I think they have a right to withhold their contributions. And I will concede that I don't know if it's right for American Jews to contribute to defeat a candidate in another country, unless that candidate is a pure anti-Semite, which obviously Netanyahu is not. So I don't know. I just don't know quite candidly.
But by the way, we should mention, just quickly, two quick things. I mean, first of all, Governor DeSantis, I just saw that article. I think I sent it to you. But Governor DeSantis is going to Israel again. I know he was there for the embassy opening. He was there prior to the embassy opening. He was there. It was his first trip he took as governor of the state of Florida. But he's going later this month on April 27th to an event that's being hosted at the Museum of Tolerance in Jerusalem. It's part of another one of his administration's trips.
Okay, here's my take on that. I think it's a complete appeal to Jewish voters. I don't think Governor DeSantis is anti-Semitic. I don't think he is a friend of the Jewish community. He did not make any comments as the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic tropes were put on buildings in Jacksonville during the Gator Bowl when they've been put over I-4. He has been silent on that. And then he always goes back, as he has in New York, with a George Soros-backed prosecutor. That's an anti-Semitic trope. He may not realize it's an anti-Semitic trope, but that is an anti-Semitic trope.
Well, you and I are going to strongly disagree on that, because George Soros, again, he has been the primary funder of the BDS movement for decades now. He hates Israel. And
he does not hate Israel, Laureen. That is an ad hominem attack on George Soros. That's not true.
If he doesn't hate Israel, then tell me, why is he the primary funder of BDS? Not just today, not just 10 years ago, but for decades now. He's been the primary funder of
all. Where has he been the primary funder of BDS?
Including in Israel. It's his money. All these organizations that hate Israel, they're fostering the BDS movement, which, by the way, to me personally, is the most dangerous movement in this country. When I think about what BDS has been able to accomplish over the last two decades on college campuses, is astounding. It is so dangerous. The man is pure evil. It is not.
Oh, no, it sounds like rich Jewish bankers are trying to control the world and tell you what to do. It is such, almost every pundit, even on Fox, I have heard.
He is a rich Jewish hedge fund guy. And by the way, there are many Jews and Jewish organizations that agree that George Soros hates Israel and he's very dangerous for Israel. In fact, even Ambassador Ron Dermer warned about George Soros.
And Ron Dermer is right wing and right along in there. I like Ron Dermer. He's a great speaker. He is a right wing supporter of Trump. He loved Trump.
Ambassador of
just
Israel.
Because Ron Dermer, I know he was the ambassador, but just because he says it, that doesn't make it MS. It's just not necessarily true.
He is the Israeli ambassador to the United States.
Was.
Government of Israel. Hold on, let me finish my point. The actual Israeli government for many, many years has considered George Soros an enemy of the state of Israel. If the one Jewish state on the face of the earth considers George Soros an enemy of the state, then guess what? Maybe we should be rethinking the way we're talking about him. I don't think it's anti-Semitic, which, by the way, we could just go back to the prosecutor in New York, because I told you about Congressman Richie Torres. Richie Torres, the congressman from the Bronx, a Democrat, Black man who is so pro-Israel. I love him. I'm so grateful for him. I mean, he wrote his letter to the Department of Justice. This goes back in January, saying, hey, we need an investigation to find out why Manhattan and why New York City has failed to prosecute and police hate crimes against the Jewish community.
I will agree that he has been remiss in that. But yeah, the blue collar crime has been the bread and butter, that's their words, not mine, of that district attorney's office. So Trump is getting the same exact dealings as any other businessman who would be investigated for blue collar crime. That is what
Okay, you know what? Great. You waste all your resources on this stupid thing.
But we can argue about that, but we can't argue that he is singling out Donald Trump
No, you know what? I'd love him to single out. I'd love him to go investigate the 100 plus hate crimes against Jews that still
I would like that as well. I would agree with you.
I mean, to me, that seems like more of a priority. When your citizens in your city are being violently assaulted and attacked on the streets because they're Jews, I think you have a priority to go prosecute the thugs who are doing it. I mean, that's just my thought, because I'd be pretty scared to be a Jew to go out walking on the street right now. I mean,
okay, let's do this. Let's do something we both agree on. BDS is BS. It really is. I'd like to say it stronger. And it is so full of BS. We want to show you who it really hurts. We got a piece here telling you about the truth about BDS that those who support it don't want you to know about.
Why did Lorde cancel her Tel Aviv concert? Why did Sally Rooney refuse to work with an Israeli publisher? And why have student governments at U.S. universities barred Israeli scholars from speaking on campus? Throughout modern history, boycotts have proven to be a powerful tool for defeating oppression and advancing change. Yet the movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel actually hurts the Palestinian economy and disrupts efforts towards peace. So who does the BDS movement really serve, if not the Palestinians? And what is the real agenda? Here are four things the anti-Israel movement doesn't want you to know. Number one, BDS misrepresents Israel as a colonialist state. Understanding the background of the BDS movement requires traveling back to 1920, when the British had double-booked a reservation in Palestine. On one hand, the Brits promised Arab nationalists they would form a united Arab country that included Palestine. Yet with the Balfour Declaration, they had also promised the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. As the Nazi war machine tore through Europe, thousands of Jewish immigrants fled back to their ancestral homeland. This influx of Jews complicated an already messy situation in the Middle East. On the one hand, Jews helped kickstart the local economy, drawing Arabs from all over the region to seek work in Palestine. But on the other hand, many Arabs viewed the Jewish immigrants to Palestine as competition, not only for resources, but for the promise of a unified pan-Arab state. To many Arabs, this flood of foreigners seemed like an extension of British colonialism. Even though many of the Jews of Palestine hated their British overlords as much, if not more, than the local Arabs. So the Arab community organized a boycott, hoping to economically choke the Jewish community in Palestine and send them packing. In 1946, seven Arab countries joined forces to boycott the goods and services produced by Jewish businesses and stymie the growth of the Jewish community in the land. The problem? Jews weren't there to colonize. They were there to return home. Jews have lived in the land of Israel continuously for 3,000 years, while diaspora Jews spent millennia yearning to return. But the Jews fleeing Europe didn't serve some colonialist power. Rather, they served the dream they'd held for 2,000 years of being a free nation in their ancestral homeland once again. And that's not to mention the millions of Jews who flocked to Israel from throughout the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. BDS has done its best to push a compelling but ultimately false narrative of white Europeans barging in and ousting the natives. Inconveniently for them, both Jews and Palestinian Arabs are ancestrally rooted in the land. So that colonialist narrative just doesn't fit. Number two, BDS doesn't help Palestinians. The BDS movement claims that they stand in solidarity with Palestinians. However, some Palestinians push back on this, arguing that boycotting Israel doesn't help Palestinians or the cause of peace. Mohammed Dajani, a Palestinian professor and peace activist, told the New York Times, "I'm against the boycott in general. We need more dialogue with the other. That's why I believe that you should not have a general boycott against Israel or a boycott against Israeli universities." Bassem Eid, a Palestinian human rights advocate, took this a step further. According to him, it's not just that BDS doesn't help Palestinians. Boycotts against Israel actually hurt them. When Ben & Jerry's announced in 2021 that it would stop selling ice cream in the West Bank, aka Judea and Samaria, he argued that it would cost Palestinians their jobs. Ben & Jerry's ice cream distributor employs Palestinians who receive good salaries and working conditions they would never be able to attain from the Palestinian Authority. Now they will lose their jobs and be unable to support their families. The fact is that Israeli and Palestinian lives are interconnected in complex ways that BDS fails to address. Palestinian business people have invested millions in joint Israeli-Palestinian venture capital. Thousands of Palestinians have founded companies and factories in Israel and Israeli industrial zones in the West Bank. All of this is what's threatened by BDS. To try and uplift Palestinians and pay heed to others' plight is a noble idea, But if your goal is to help Palestinians, BDS isn't the way to do it. Number three, BDS promotes anti-Semitic ideas. Although BDS speaks about lofty concepts like justice and human rights, its true aims are far more sinister. BDS co-founder and leader Omar Barghouti freely admits that the movement opposes a Jewish state in any part of Palestine.
Most definitely we oppose a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian, rational Palestinian, not a sellout Palestinian, will ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine.
You don't need to read too far into that statement to see that BDS isn't advocating for a Palestinian state alongside a Jewish state, but rather the end of the Jewish state, period. This is the literal definition of anti-Semitism, denying the Jewish people the right to self-determination by claiming that the existence of a state of Israel is a racist endeavor. Take BDS Boston's mapping project, which literally mapped out a variety of Jewish institutions with any sort of ties to Israel, publishing the names and addresses of these places and their employees. The project includes a disturbing and anti-Semitic call to dismantle and disrupt every network listed, with the thinly veiled threat: every entity has an address, every network can be disrupted. The institutions targeted? A Jewish high school, a center for people with disabilities, student groups, synagogues, Jewish-run charities, and a center for Jewish arts, among others. It's one thing to criticize or disagree with the Israeli government's policies, but denying the Jewish people the right to self-determination and threatening the Jewish community even outside of Israel? That's textbook anti-Semitism. Number four, BDS prevents peace. Peace requires an exchange of ideas and a deep understanding of one another's cultures. BDS does the opposite of that. It ensures that Palestinian and Israeli academics, musicians, and artists will not be able to interact. Peace requires dialogue. BDS shuts conversation down. Peace requires compromise and mutual recognition. BDS refuses to recognize the right of Jews to live independently in their ancestral homeland. Building a sustainable peace requires cooperation and openness. Peace needs well-intentioned individuals who are willing to approach the conflict in all of its complexity, to see the shades of gray beyond the simple black and white, to approach one another with an ear towards understanding and empathy. A true movement for justice doesn't champion one persecuted people at the expense of the other. Rather, it champions all of humanity to live in freedom and peace. So if you're going to boycott anything, consider boycotting BDS.
And truly, Laureen, it's the Palestinians that are hurt much more than the Israelis.
We just talked about it last week. There was a council of Islamic clerics in Iraq who were calling for a fatwa against Hamas because of the cruel treatment of Hamas, of the Palestinian people. You know, because the Palestinian people, there's been that quiet movement within Gaza of Palestinians going on social media and telling their stories about how the brutality of Hamas to the Palestinian people and how they have suffered, how they can't be educated, how they can't have businesses anymore, how they're living in poverty and lack, while all the Hamas terrorists are living lives of luxury and it's like living in a dictatorship. And yet when you talk to people like, oh, well, I'm pro-Palestinian, I'm justice in Palestine, they could care less about these people. So it's a lie. They actually don't care about the Palestinian people. So when they tell you that, challenge them, question them, ask them, well, what are you doing about the people who are suffering under Hamas right now? Do you know about their movement? Do you know what they're trying to do? Do you know about the fatwa? Challenge them. I think that's our biggest problem, Mike. As Jews, we're afraid to challenge these people who claim this is all about justice. Oh, we care about people. Like, it's a lie. They don't.
It's true. I would agree with you. Listen, we have a really uplifting story to take a left turn coming up with the owner of the New England Patriots, a team I don't usually love, but this guy's a real mensch, Robert Kraft. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is The Third Opinion. That interview in just a moment. But have you looked at our webpage where you can listen to previous editions of The Third Opinion podcast? Find out more about our hosts and leave a comment or two. And now, back to the Third Opinion podcast and that interview. Welcome back to the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Now, Laureen, Robert Kraft is the owner of the New England Patriots. He is a very competitive guy, came from humble beginnings. But he has also, besides a man who's been very successful, is a proud Jewish man, and is concerned about the anti-Semitism that is going on.
Yeah, you know what? And one, I mean, apart from what he's doing now, which is pretty extraordinary, I mean, for years he would take his teams, the Patriots, he would take them to Israel so they could see firsthand, you know, that Israel's not an apartheid state. They could see firsthand the beauty of Israel. And I mean, I just so appreciate that about him, the personal investment that he would make.
You know. Yeah, like I said, he is a real mensch. And Harry Smith, who's one of my favorite reporters, did a piece for NBC about Robert Kraft. And you'll be seeing little blue lapel pins and squares on TV because of what Robert Kraft is doing. Let's take a listen.
If you watch the NFL, you know Bob Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, frequent holder of Super Bowl trophies. He grew up a local kid, working class.
Was your household a religious household?
Very traditional. You know, I lucked out. We were modest financially, but I had amazing parents who gave great love. I grew up in an observant Jewish home.
Early on, Kraft learned a thing or two about uniting people.
I went to Brooklyn High School. I got elected president of the senior class, and all the toughest Irish Catholic kids from Brookline Village helped get me elected.
The local kid made good.
I mean, I'd pinch myself. Here's a kid who went to school on scholarship. I didn't have a car till I was 25.
Yet Kraft laments the loss of our connectedness.
We're connected from a technical point of view, but I think there's a loneliness and separation that has developed. I think that's caused a certain divisiveness and in some ways has been very destructive and detrimental to our great way of life here in America.
For him, most pointedly, most personally, the rise in anti-Semitism.
Multiple gunshots are heard.
11 innocent lives slain in a house of worship.
My holy place has been defiled.
You will not replace us!
I cannot be anti-Semitic if I know where I come from.
Drivers were greeted with this anti-Semitic banner.
Anti-Semitism is on the rise, and Kraft is determined to help stop it.
What's happening now, to me, looks similar to what was going on in Germany in the late 30s. The Jewish people represent 2.4% of the population, but they receive 55% of the hate crimes. That really prompted me to start this new foundation.
You wouldn't start it unless you felt you could make a difference.
Yes.
Can this make a difference?
You know, you get this little field out here. You either win or you lose. Everything I've done, I try to execute and not just talk about things.
So in this room, near his office in Gillette Stadium.
Morning, everyone.
Is the foundation to combat anti-Semitism that tracks and responds to anti-Semitism online.
We're monitoring all the things that are being said and come into us about anti-Semitism.
Because social media is just filled with this vitriol, with this hatred.
People can say anything,
yeah.
And it's like it's factual, and it takes on its own life.
Due to the real-time fashion of it, we're able to respond to things fairly quick. And in the end, we're putting out content to really educate those who are unaware of what's happening online.
Soon you'll begin to see this symbol on social media, a blue square with a hashtag.
That 2.4% square is what the U.S. Jewish population is. On its own, it can't make a dent in this problem if it doesn't have allies. Join us in this effort of combating anti-Semitism. I'm going to give you one that you can think about what you want to do with it.
I know what to do with it.
Well, that's really cool.
That's not hard.
You know, it's a simple sign of we need more bridge building and solidarity together.
But Kraft's campaign goes beyond social media. Starting today, across all manner of media, important messages.
Hi, Mr. Coney.
How did you respond when
I got chills, almost tears.
Yeah.
And he had that white paint on his shoe where he painted over the swastika. We're asking in that ad for Americans to help.
The haters are noisy, violent, aggressive. And the ads are almost the opposite. Just like I'm putting my hand out to you and saying, can't we
connect?
Connect.
Your prayer really inspired us.
Connect and have the courage to stand up against hate before it's too late.
So at 81, is there a part of you that says, I need to do this now?
Yeah, this is a legacy investment. You know, most people like to play between the 40-yard lines and not get roughed up. We're in a situation in the country where this is all red zone material. We got to go down and but do what's right.
And here's one of the other really interesting things that Bob said was, if this continues unchecked, the anti-Semitism, it's also really bad for black people and brown people and Asian people and minority after minority after minority. He remembers, you know, he reads his history. Mm-hmm. You look at the beginning of Mein Kampf, everything is blamed on the Jews. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then other groups get ushered into.
I didn't say anything when they came for the others.
Yeah, that's
now
it.
Now you just gave me goosebumps.
Yeah.
This is so interesting, right? The small blue screen you see in your screen right there, that small square takes up 2.4% of your TV screen or whatever screen you're on, like the 2.4% of Jews in America. Yet again, they are targets of more than 55% of all religious hate crimes in this country. So it's time to stand up, right? I've got some of these if you want to.
I was just going to say.
You can pass those along. And Carson, I understand. This you're gonna.
This is not my first time wearing this pin, no.
Really?
Right?
No.
You have a response to this on The Voice.
Yes, we've done. You know, we've tried to in primetime on NBC. You know, get behind this, and you know the numbers are staggering. They're alarming. 55%, obviously alarming of 2.4, but just even if you zoom in even more from 2021 to 2022. According to ADL, the Jewish hate crimes were up 36%. So it's an immediate problem. It's a big problem. It's an immediate problem. Yeah. So this messaging you'll see tonight on The Voice. You'll see that blue box on The Voice. You'll see it on Kelly Clarkson's show. You'll see it on Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen.
Right.
And some other people trying to get the word out.
Harry, that was beautiful. Beautiful story. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for watching. Don't miss the Today Show every weekday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 Pacific on our streaming channel, Today All Day. To watch, head to today.com/allday or click the link right here.
Now, that little blue square shows on the screen how small the Jewish population is, and then yet we're the target of 55% of all the anti-Semitism. So we got to find out, Laurie, where we can get those little blue pins.
Right, 55% of all the
hate crimes.
That's a big deal, which, by the way, we should talk this week. You know, one of our favorite people, and I say that very facetiously, Jeremy Corbyn.
This is a mitzvah for all of us.
Right. So this is great news. So Jeremy Corbyn, as many of you probably recall, he was the head of the Labour Party for many years, almost became Prime Minister of England. Thank God he did not. But then they had this disastrous election, pretty much because he allowed anti-Semitism to run rampant within the Labour Party. The people of England and the Labour Party rejected it. And they voted Keir Starmer to become the new head of the Labour Party. Under Keir Starmer, he's been taking a lot of corrective action within the Labour Party. And he finally had enough votes to say to Jeremy Corbyn that when you run for re-election, you cannot run as a member of the Labour Party. So it was a vote of the executive committee, 22 to 12. So there are still 12 people of the executive committee of the Labour Party that thought Jeremy Corbyn should run as a Labour member, but fortunately the voice of reason and those who stand against hate won. And Keir Starmer just said there's no place for hate. There's just no place for anti-Semitism.
And his wife is Jewish. That's I was surprised to learn that. You told me that.
Yes, Keir Starmer's white is Jewish. And I just, you know, look, this is a big deal because when we saw how close Jeremy Corbyn could have become to becoming the Prime Minister of England and that he was so anti-Semitic, you know, and he thought that, you know, that Arafat and all these, you know, terrorists were wonderful people and friends. And that's alarming.
And, yeah, to say the least. But then, right. Going back to what Robert Kraft was talking about in that piece, that 55% of the hate crimes in the United States are against Jews. And there is a columnist in Israel, Hillel Fulton, who I was not familiar with his work, and I looked up, and he's got some real basis for things, and he is saying to American Jews, why don't you leave? This is Germany in the 30s. I don't necessarily agree, but I just thought it was astounding that we're even talking about something like this, and I really wanted to share it. Let's take a listen. We'll talk about it on the other side.
We're speaking with Hillel Fuld, who recently wrote a column called American Jews Get Out Now. Why did you write a column called that?
You know, since I'm a little kid, having grandparents who survived Auschwitz, I've always struggled with the question, why didn't they get out? Right? I mean, Nuremberg laws. I mean, these guys, full-blown, like, anti-Semitism, mainstream society in Europe, the Jews just stuck around. And I always, like, I asked myself, what, like, why didn't they read the writing on the wall? What had to happen? And I never understood it. I always struggled with that. Now I look at America right now, you got full-blown pop artists, Kanye West, going full-blown anti-Semite. You got Saturday Night Live normalizing anti-Semitism. You got NBA players, full-blown anti-Semites. What has to happen? Jews being beaten up in the streets? Done. It's done. But what has to happen for the Jews to say, all right, enough is enough. This is not our home. Now, you know, we always grew up saying never again. Obviously, the Holocaust can never happen again. The truth is, it could never happen again because we have Israel. But American Jews, I think they're not looking at history. I think they're maybe ignoring, you know, what went on throughout the Jewish, you know, history, from the Spanish Inquisition to the pogroms to the Holocaust. You know, we got too comfortable.
So when you say, like, people are being beaten in the streets, are they being beaten in the streets? Like, where's that happening?
Are you serious? You've never seen these videos of Hasidic Jews walking in Brooklyn being beaten up middle of the, I mean, it's I see it pretty much every day on my Facebook feeds. Every day.
So it's getting and, to be like that.
Yeah, I mean, literally last night, a friend of mine on Twitter, she said she was walking with her family in the street, and some African-American came over and said, oh, we're going to kill all you Jews. And everyone stood around watching this thing, yelling in her face, cursing her kids and everything. People stood around watching. Nobody said a word. Nobody did a thing. The whole thing doesn't make any sense because, you know, the Jews are, like, statistically non-existent. We're so small, right? 20% of all Nobel Prizes were given to Jews. Do you know that? 20%. I mean, there's something remarkable about the Jewish people. I don't think anyone would debate that. We survived, and the Romans didn't, and the Greeks didn't, and the Nazis didn't. We're here, right? But there is this, I don't know. I mean, I can tell you my theory of why anti-Semitism exists, but there is this just historic thing that just keeps showing its ugly face every generation. And again, it's unfortunate that Jews forget history. I mean, look at Germany. You don't have to think about 300 years. I'm talking about Germany 80 years ago. I mean, they were comfortable until they weren't. So what has to happen? Like, I ask my friends in the States, what has to happen? Is there an event that will happen that you'll say enough is enough? What has to happen? It's all happened. I don't know what they're waiting for.
The outside world where I just moved from, people think Israel is just, like, totally under terrorism all the time and stuff like that. Is it safe for Jews to move here?
First of all, I don't know if you know, but my older brother was murdered in a terrorist attack. So I know it firsthand, okay? I'm not, every life that's lost is an entire world. Having said that, we have to look at the grand scheme of things. Take a step back. There has never been a 75-year period. Listen to this statistics. It's phenomenal. It's just fascinating. There has never been a 75-year period since the destruction of the temple that there were so few Jews killed in the world. So, again, every life that's lost to terrorism is a horrible tragedy. But in the grand scheme of things, this country is defending us. Whereas there, we're at the mercy of everyone else. And we know how that turns out. So, you know, yeah, I think it is significantly safer here. And I'm not belittling. There is terror, but in the grand scheme of things, it's in our hands. This is our home. I heard someone say, in America, you can succeed despite being a Jew. In Israel, you succeed because you're a Jew. And to me, that's what it comes down to. And by the way, someone recently said to me, they moved to Israel. He said, not because I'm a Zionist, but because I'm a capitalist. which is amazing because this is where it's all going on in terms of technology and innovation. So, you know, we're living the dream. It's never been this good for the Jewish people, and I'm proud to live here. I'm a big talker. My parents brought me here. I didn't make a decision. I want to believe that had he not brought me here, I would have come myself. But in America, it's scary. It's scary times.
Well, those are all good reasons to get out of America. We've been speaking with Hillel Fold about his column, American Jews Get Out Now.
Now, Lorene, I don't think we're being foolish. I don't think we're Germany in the 30s. Would you agree?
No, I don't think we're Germany in the 30s, but I do think we've got, you know, a very open rise of anti-Semitism in this country, and it goes on both sides of the aisle, far right, far left. It's dangerous. And I think part of the problem is what we know is the danger is being silent when reasonable people just don't speak up when they hear hate. And I think that's where we and being
absolutely let's take an example. George Washington University.
Oh God, that horrific professor. Lara Shahid. You know, Mike, you and I had talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
So there's a DEI mandatory diversity course at George Washington University all students have to take, including all the Jewish students. And it's taught by this Palestinian woman, Shahid. And she just openly berates the Jewish students and calls them Islamophobic, attacks them in front of all their classmates. These Jewish white supremacy and all kinds of things. I mean, these poor kids are like literally they are.
They're terrified to be in her class.
Right. And but more importantly, they're being defamed in front of all their classmates. And beyond that, she's then going and defaming them within the university to professors. So if you're looking to do higher studies or master's programs or different things, these professors now have an opinion of you because this woman, Shahid, is going behind their backs and talking to these professors. So these kids filed a complaint with George Washington University about the anti-Semitism. And the university pretty much, you know, retaliated against the students and said,
it is incredible to me.
They're like, we think her pro-Palestinian voice should be heard. She's a minority. You're privileged. You don't really have a right to speak out. And like through the university, these poor kids are literally being attacked openly in front of the entire university. Open, blatant racism.
It's horrible. Okay. All right, Lorene, get in the batter's box. Get ready. I'm going to pitch you another softball. San Diego State University.
Which, by the way, is in the basketball tournament tonight.
That's right. We're taping this Monday night before the final game of the Final Four. So we don't know which team is going to win. By the time you hear this, you will know. We will not. Go ahead, Lorene.
Right, which, by the way, very disappointed that the FAU Owls lost to San Diego State. I really felt like FAU should have won. For those of you listening who watched the game, I thought, you know, there were some bad calls in that game. And anyway, very disappointing. But so there is a Chabad house there at San Diego State University. It's been there since 1977. They've got this beautiful large menorah that has come under attack a couple of times. But once again, just recently, this past week, you know, another person came and vandalized our menorah, this huge menorah, and knocked it over, which, you know, again, really shouldn't surprise. I mean, the university, contrary to like a complete opposite of George Washington University, the San Diego State University actually did come out and strongly condemned it. They were very upset about what had happened. It stood with the Jewish community there at the university. Like I said, very unlike.
I was pleased as well, but it's just so bad that it happened. Well, listen, you hear that music, means we're out of time. Happy Passover, everybody. Lorene, I know you're cooking like a crazy person. Thank you for listening to us. This is the Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Bye. That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget, subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.